Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Well, my name is Courtney, and I'm an alcoholic, and I spent a good time of this evening when I should have been eating dinner, looking out over this rather impressive gathering and thinking, gee, this is an awfully funny looking AA meeting. But gradually, as Burton began to speak, I began to realize that this is an AA meeting, and my only function as an alcoholic and an AA member is to tell you something about what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And as a matter of fact, because my drinking career was rather long, I usually contract that a little bit. I usually leave out what I'm like now, partly because I'm not entirely sure. On this matter, I think the best answer can be given in the words of the two men who met on the street. Man number one said to man number two, "How's your wife?" And man number two said, "Compared to what?" Well, compared to what it was, it's better. I had quite a long drinking career. It lasted about 35 years. And the fact that I am sober and alive after a drinking career of that length suggests that I must be some kind of slow-motion alcoholic. And this is about the case. I think it is probable that through the first 25 years of my drinking career, I may not have been an alcoholic at all. Temperamentally, yes, from childhood. But the reason I say I may not have been an alcoholic during those early years was because at that time, I could do the two things that it seems to me an alcoholic cannot do. The first thing I could do was to choose the times when I drank. And the second thing I could do was stop. But then something changed. Not overnight. I don't even know what year. But gradually, I lost the ability to choose the times when I drank. I became a compulsive drinker. I had to have something to drink every day. Now, I didn't know this. I thought, as I had heard my doctor say, that as a man gets along into mature years, if he works in a tense profession, as I do, a little alcohol to relax with at the end of the day is a pretty good idea. Alcohol, you know, is the tranquilizer and sedative that mankind has had a longer experience with than any other. And so it's natural when we have this much experience with a sedative that we should use it for that purpose when it's needed. And the doctor and I thought that it was needed. It seemed to me an excellent idea to have a couple of martinis before dinner, a little brandy with the coffee afterwards, possibly a scotch and soda or two before bedtime. This all made good sense. But actually, I was a compulsive drinker. I had to have something to drink every day. I spent all my waking hours, I realize now, thinking about drinking during this period, thinking what I would have that day, where I would have it, when I would have it, how much I would allow myself. So I think this was the time when I became an alcoholic. I was now on the top of the ski jump, starting down. But I couldn't possibly know any of these things because I still had the other ability that, to me, alcoholics lack. I could still stop. I drank this way compulsively, but with control, for perhaps 5 years. And then the second change occurred. this time my drinking went out of control. And so there gradually emerged the particular pattern of drinking that I had when I came to AA. I emphasize my particular pattern because it seems to me, on the basis of what I've seen, that there are all kinds of patterns of drinking among alcoholics. We have among us the periodic drinkers, the men and women who can remain without drinking for days, weeks, months, and sometimes years, sometimes without even the desire. Then they take one drink and the roof falls in. Frankly, I don't understand this type of alcoholic. Then we have the other type, the daily drinker like myself, and among us there's a very wide variation. I have seen men and women come into AA on what I would consider nothing, a few ounces of hard liquor at a time, and yet they're alcoholics. I know their stories, and I know it. At the other extreme, I have a very good friend in Los Angeles who came to AA after 40 years of drinking. At the end, he was consuming 3/5 of scotch a day and taking 30 grams of amytal with it, which in itself is 2 or 3 times a killing dose. Well, those are the extremes that I've observed myself. And based on these extremes, I've come to the conclusion that I'm what you might call the normal, typical, everyday type of alcoholic. At the end, I was drinking about a quart of gin a day. I didn't drink this every day. I'd drink it for 2 or 3 days until I was more or less exhausted. Then I'd drop down to what was nothing for me, half a pint or so, and then I'd build it back to the quart. I suppose I ran through 2 of these cycles every 10 or 12 days. Now, for some people, this might be normal social drinking, but it wasn't for me. It was a full-time job, day and night. It left me no time for anything else. I recognized that something was wrong, and so I did what was natural for me under these conditions. I went to a first-class Beverly Hills psychiatrist for help specifically with my drinking problem. I went to this man for more than 2 years. I got a great deal of help from him in many areas of my life, but my drinking continued to get worse and worse. Now, I don't blame him for this. I don't blame psychiatry, and I don't blame medicine. I had a great deal of first-class medical care at the same time. I recognize now that there are many diseases of the body that medicine cannot deal with successfully in the present state of knowledge, and we don't blame medicine for this. Muscular dystrophy is a good example. Leukemia is another. We know that the researchers are working on it, and we hope that someday they'll find the solution. Similarly, there are illnesses of the mind and the emotions and the spirit that psychiatry apparently cannot deal with successfully in the present state of knowledge, and active alcoholism is one of them. So one morning in the summer of 1957, the psychiatrist told me flatly, and in just about these words, that I was a chronic, and I thought he said hopeless, alcoholic. He hadn't actually said hopeless. That was what I read into his expression and his tone of voice. He recommended that I go to a hospital or a sanitarium to dry out. But he also told me, frankly, that the moment they released me, I would resume drinking. He said what would happen would be that I would recover a little health so I could drink longer. I didn't understand this peculiar comment because I didn't know that our family doctor had told my wife that I was drinking myself to death, that absolutely nothing could be done about it, and I could not possibly hope to live more than another year or so. Well, since I didn't know this verdict, but I had the other one from the psychiatrist, I decided that under these circumstances, I might as well resign from psychiatry and undertake a self-treatment at home. Now, by a self-treatment, I didn't mean stopping drinking. What I meant was trying to get back to the pattern of drinking that I had once enjoyed and practiced successfully, it seemed to me, for so many years. So, being a methodical kind of guy, I looked up alcoholism in a standard medical textbook and got a pretty bad scare. But I did notice it said something about bromides under hospital conditions. Well, it seemed to me that my home was practically a hospital by now anyhow. So I laid in a large supply of bromides, triple bromides, and started taking 15 grains a day, adding them to some of the things I was already taking. The phenobarbital, the secanol, the nembutal, the codeine in the 1 grain tablets for the headaches, you can understand that. And along in here, my doctor began to help me. He's a fairly well-known internist, and like all men of this type, he receives floods of new and comparatively untried medications from the major drug houses who ask him to try them on his patients and see what happens. Clinical research, as it is called in the medical profession. Well, I believe now that he picked out of this daily assortment all the drugs that affected the central nervous system and passed them over to me on the theory that at this stage nothing could do any harm and something might do some good. So I began to get quite an assortment of drugs. I won't detail them, but I remember that one of them, one of the first, was a drug called Talserol. Now, this is a muscle relaxer, and we both agreed at the time that my muscles needed relaxing. He told me that he had heard of a man who took 7 of these tablets at one time without any appreciable damage. They were still establishing the dosage. I took either 21 or 23 one night, and I recall looking up at his face from the bathroom floor as he was telling my wife that my blood pressure was 0. But I was relaxed. And for that purpose, at least, I can recommend Talserol. Well, I had other drugs. I had the standard tranquilizers. I received the so-called psychic energizers. I had drugs that would relax me, that would put me to sleep, that would wake me up, that would make me go sidewise. I took them all by the handful. After all, they were free, most of them. But I continued washing them down with this quart of gin a day, and it gradually began to be apparent to me that my home treatment was not a complete success. By now, I was having a number of the symptoms that many of us have had. Some alcoholics toward the end lose weight. Others gain. I was a gainer. I then carried something like 60 pounds more than I'm carrying now, and this tonnage was of a most impressive royal purple color. I looked like a barrel of grape jelly on legs, but I didn't smell like one, they tell me. At any rate, I had this experience. I was having experiences like crawling up a long hall on hands and knees in what seemed to be a 150-mile-an-hour wind to where the gin was kept and then having the first one or two bounce before one would stay down. I was having the blackouts, which terrified me. I was having the hallucinations, the voices, which terrified me. I was hearing the music, which I miss. The music in my case was perfectly beautiful. It was always symphonic music, the type I liked. It was like having one of the symphonic type of radio stations with me. This was before transistor radios. Wherever I went, the music went. So I miss that. But what I don't miss, but never want to forget, are the terrors of the night that many of us know so well. Waking up in the middle of the night with a start of fear, this feeling of imminent doom or disaster about to strike from some unknown direction, shaking with fear, perspiring, the bed full of perspiration, occasionally more than perspiration. This type of experience began to convince me that my home treatment was not a complete success, and I began to think of AA. I had heard of AA. I had been finding AA pamphlets all around the house and reading them on the sly. but I didn't feel that I was quite ready. I had a somewhat mistaken impression about you. I thought you all lived under bridges and behind signboards and crept out at night into dark holes and corners and there with teeth and fists clenched told each other not to drink, and this prospect was not particularly attractive. I had another more personal reason. These gyrations had taken me just about to Christmas of 1957, and I am one of those alcoholics who is not going to go to AA voluntarily just before Christmas if I can make it through the holidays. And I did. Actually, I made it into the middle of January of 1958. And even then, I must confess, I did not come to you voluntarily or even under my own power. I was taken against my will and by force. This happened because one morning in mid-January, a minister dropped in to see me one morning. He was a good friend of mine, not an alcoholic, and I was not a member of his church. I greeted him in the pajamas and bathrobe I had worn through the last half of the holidays. We went down into the living room, sat down in a couple of chairs, and talked about absolutely nothing for half an hour. He didn't bring up the subject of drinking, and I certainly wasn't going to, but I knew why he was there, of course, and he knew I knew. He went away, and later that day or the next day, in a burst of honesty, I wrote him a letter. I told him that drinking had got out of control with me, and if he had anything to suggest, I would just as soon hear it. So he came back a morning or so later, same time in the morning. I was wearing the same costume. We went down and sat in the same chairs, but the dialogue was different. He's had a lot of experience with alcoholics, and he really laid it on the line. He gave me what was essentially a pitch. He capped this pitch by saying that he had known AA to help people like me, and if I were willing, he would be willing to take me to a meeting. I said, sure, I'd be glad to go, which was a lie. But I thought he was talking about a meeting, if it were like most organizations I'd known, probably would be held once a month, and the next meeting would probably be in about 2 weeks. In other words, I assumed he was softening me up. But he's dealt with people like me. He merely said, fine, there's a meeting at Brentwood tonight. I'll call for you at 8 o'clock, and he was out of there before I could open my mouth. This made me nervous. When he arrived, I was shaved, dressed, and drunk. Between the time of his leaving and his return, I had drunk at least a fifth of gin, and I couldn't even stand up. But he's bigger than I am, determined. He didn't argue. He just got a hold of me, hauled me outside, stuffed me into his car, drove me down this dark January night to where the parking lot was, hauled me out of the parking lot, up a flight of stairs, and into a tremendous, brilliantly lighted room. When I could see, I thought there were 10,000 people in there, all looking at me, and they were. People hardly ever get taken to that meeting quite as drunk as I was. But I was escorted into the back of the room, seated in a chair, and my first AA meeting took place, and that's all I can tell you about it, except that there was a great deal of laughter. Since Elsa is here, however, I must tell you that I learned months later that the speaker at that meeting was Chuck C. But you'll never prove it by me. You can prove it by him, however. He embarrassed me rather considerably down around Newport Beach a couple of years ago when he told the delighted audience that although I was way in back and he was way up here, he could smell me from where he stood. At any rate, something must have happened because getting ready for the next meeting the next night, I drank only about a pint. And thus I have a vague recollection of this meeting. There were two speakers, and the first one, a woman, said something about getting drunk, getting into her car, driving into a tree, and flying through the windshield, and everybody laughed. And this made a tremendous impression on me. Well, that was my second meeting. The next night, which was a Saturday, I was taken to the Malibu meeting. This is a rather remarkable thing because it's held in the courtroom of the sheriff's station, and the speaker speaks from behind the judge's bench, which is quite a switch for some of us. But at any rate, I was comparatively sober by now. I'd had only 9 or 10 ounces getting ready for this meeting, and so I was seated right up front instead of in back. And for the first time, I heard something that is a custom in Southern California. At every meeting in Southern California, the opening consists of the reading of the first portion of Chapter 5 of the Big Book, the part that includes the 12 steps and ends with that little ABC section. Now, up to this time, I hadn't heard anybody read anything from anything. I didn't even know there was a book. I certainly didn't understand what was read, although in Southern California we get to hearing this thousands of times, but I don't think many people do out there at their first meetings. What I got out of it was that AA seemed to involve some kind of more or less organized program of recovery, and it had a textbook or a manual of recovery. Well, fortunately for me, the man who took me to that meeting lent me a copy of the book when he dropped me off at his house. And that night, lying in bed with one hand over one eye, for understandable reasons, I read through almost the entire book. I think I skipped the chapter to the employer, but I didn't have one at the time and I wasn't interested. But I suppose reading that book was the equivalent of attending another dozen or 15 AA meetings, because along with other material, the back of the book contains the personal stories of 37 recovered alcoholics, and I could identify with some of them. At any rate, I haven't had a drink since. Now, that Malibu meeting took place January 18th, 1958, and what I have to talk about now is what happened. Specifically, what happened to me in terms of what I have come to think of as the gifts I received from AA or through AA. See, when I woke up the morning of the 19th, a Sunday, I hadn't the faintest idea that I would go through the entire day without taking a drink. There was still something to drink in the house. I certainly had no idea that I would go through the next and the next and the next, and then I would be telling you about it nearly 7.5 years later. Now, one reason I didn't know was because I had had the idea that if you go to AA and it takes, so to speak, the desire to drink falls away from you like a discarded cloak. And it didn't fall away from me. I had an intense desire to drink, but I didn't drink. Now, this doesn't surprise me as much now as it did then. I've seen the same thing happen to too many other people. In fact, if you read the Big Book and read Dr. Bob's story in it, the story of the co-founder of AA, you will find that Dr. Bob tells in it how he had an intense desire to drink for more than 2 years after he stopped drinking. But he didn't drink either. I have a kind of hunch that the reason may have been the same in both cases. I believe now I had lost not the desire, but something much more important. I had lost the compulsion, that strange, mysterious power or force, whatever it is, that had me drinking when I knew I shouldn't, when I knew perfectly well what was going to happen, and sometimes when I didn't even want to. This went away, leaving me with the desire. And the desire I could handle. I've always been able to handle desires, as I think most of us have. I think we're pretty strong-willed people, by and large. Like you, perhaps, I have a desire, sometimes quite intense, especially when the Christmas bills come in, every time I walk into a bank and see what's on the other side of the counter. I have similar desires sometimes when I walk past jewelry store windows. But I haven't yielded to these desires up to now. I have other desires, even at my age, but this sort of thing I manage to cope with most of the time anyhow. And so I naturally wondered what had happened. Now, I know what it felt like. I came into that first AA meeting physically bowed down. I think of myself as carrying a heavy weight on my back, something like a big sack of sand weighing 200 or 300 pounds. Something that had happened in those early meetings and through the reading of the book had punctured that sack of sand, and gradually the load in it had dribbled away. When it was gone, I was free. For the first time in my life, I believe, in a totally new way. Because what that sack contained, I think, and what the load consisted of, were the components of the compulsion. The one I was most aware of then, and the one I always mention first now, is a feeling that, so far as I have been able to discover, is shared by every alcoholic I have ever met in my life, drunk or sober. I don't say alcoholics are the only ones who have this feeling, but all alcoholics, in my experience, have it. This was a feeling that I used to think of as loneliness, but I have heard speakers speak of it in all kinds of ways, and I think we're talking about the same thing. It's a feeling of being on the outside when others are on the inside. It's a feeling of being rejected without a voice or a hand being raised to reject you. It's a feeling of not belonging. It's a feeling of being inferior when you know that you are not inferior. Whatever it is, this feeling went away, and along with it, many of those other painful feelings that I had as an alcoholic, the remorse, the humiliation, the resentment, the self-pity, and all the rest of it. When they were gone, I was free. Now, I wondered what happened, and so I used to attend those early AA meetings, listening most to the drunkologues, these heroic drinking stories of which we have so many in AA, some of which we have heard the last few days. Well, to my dismay, I began to come to the conclusion, after not very much of this, that instead of being the worst drinker in the world, as I had thought when I was taken into AA, that I was nothing but a patty-waste drinker. This began to embarrass me quite a bit. But you see, I had always been a gentlemanly drinker. This was the way it seemed to me. I had begun drinking during Prohibition, home brew and that sort of thing. But in the middle 30s, I began associating with some of the fairly high-up executives, particularly in the automobile industry and in Detroit. And these men were mostly martini drinkers. They drank martinis before lunch, and I wanted to be like them. I admired them, and so I drank martinis too. Unlike them, however, I had improved the martini over the years. I had improved it by eliminating the non-essentials. Gradually, I had eliminated first the olive, then the vermouth, then the ice, and then the glass. But I was still a gentlemanly drinker, at least in my own estimation. And I want to illustrate this with one little episode because it makes a point. And then I will drop this part of the subject. This happened perhaps a year before I came to AA. My son, who was then 15 or 16, was having dinner with us this evening. And during dinner, he said something disrespectful to me. It was worse than disrespectful. It was insulting. And I will have to say on his behalf that it is true that my face had fallen into my plate once or perhaps twice. I don't remember exactly. At any rate, I realized that I had to do something to reprimand this boy. I had to make him ashamed of himself, naturally, as a father, and I had to make him respect me. And you fathers will understand that my natural impulse was to reach across the table and slug him. But I don't believe in slugging children. And in any case, this particular child happened to stand well over 6 feet. 200 pounds of nothing but muscle. So that was out. What was I going to do? I pondered this question for a while, keeping my face carefully out of the plate. And finally, the solution occurred to me. I noticed that he had a glass of milk beside his plate. And so, to make him ashamed of himself, and to make him respect me, with great deliberation, looking him dead in the eye, I slowly reached across the table, picked up the glass of milk, and poured it over my own head. Now, I don't tell this story to prove that I'm an alcoholic, because it doesn't. Anybody could get drunk the first time in his life and do something equally idiotic. What it proves is quite different. You see, you found this story funny. Well, I think it's funny. I tell it all the time. My family thinks it's funny now. But when it happened, nobody thought it was funny. I was indignant. They were stunned. But when I sobered up a little bit, I was simply consumed with humiliation and remorse. I felt so bad that within the next 2 hours, I had to drink myself into complete unconsciousness so I wouldn't feel those terrible feelings. Well, they're all gone now. They're gone in the telling of this story and in the listening to stories like it. And here is where I come to the first two great gifts I received from AA. Because through these stories that we tell, I soon began to discover that underneath we are alike. We feel the same way. We all have in our backgrounds these humiliating, embarrassing episodes, the kind of things that make us break out in sweat at night. For the first time in my life, I was home. I was with people who felt the same way I did. This was what I learned. So the first great gift I got from you was the gift of identification, the realization that I was with my own family, my own people. Now, this is enormously important to me because I believe, I have come to believe, that in some way that I can't define, alcoholics don't feel quite the same way other people feel. I think if they felt the way we do, they'd be alcoholics too. And so I was with you. You were sober. You were contented. I heard these hair-raising stories. And what happened? Whenever anybody told one of these stories, everybody laughed. And this laughter was not the laughter of ridicule. It was the laughter of sympathetic understanding. And in this laughter, I think the hatred, the remorse, the humiliation, resentment, the self-pity simply dissolved. So that was the second gift, this blessed, precious gift of laughter. I think it was these two gifts, identification and laughter, that got me sober. By themselves, I don't think they would have kept me sober as long as I have been sober. I received a third gift at the same time. I'm separating these things out, but they really happened. Together, it's merely easier to talk about them this way. The third gift I received was the gift of knowledge of what was wrong with me. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous feeling an outcast, alone, unique, a moral leper, weak-willed, and I was told immediately that this was not necessarily true at all, but that I was sick, that I suffered from a disease, which is recognized as a disease by the American Medical Association and the World Health Organization. This news made me feel a great deal better. I'd had serious illnesses before, and to know that I had another one, that it was medically recognized, and something could be done about it, improved my spirits immensely. What it did for me was to take the hysteria out of it and reduce the whole thing to solid medical common sense. Well, I became so interested that I began reading up on the disease, attending meetings where AA doctors spoke. Eventually, as I accumulated a library, a series of circumstances occurred which brought me into contact with the professional researchers and the experts into alcoholism, most of them not alcoholics themselves, but the recognized authorities. And so over the years, I have picked up really quite a lot of information about alcoholism. But I should tell you that to me as an alcoholic, most of this information is useless. There is some, however, that's important to me. And this little part that's important, I'd like to pass along to you for what it's worth. I had thought, for instance, that if alcoholism were a disease, it was a rare skid row type of disease. And this simply isn't the case. The U.S. Public Health Service now rates alcoholism as one of the four leading public health problems in the United States. Alcoholism is one of the three most common killing diseases. In California, Governor Brown has recently said in a press conference that it is California's number one public health problem. All the authorities agree that the number of alcoholics in the United States is at least 5 million. In my own state of California, I think I can say frankly that the figures are staggering. In California, all the estimates agree, and I'm quoting now the official figures from the Bureau of Alcoholic Research and Rehabilitation of the California Department of Public Health. In California, the estimates are that there are more than 800,000 alcoholics. In my own county, Los Angeles County, there are more than 327,000 alcoholics. That is a little more than 8% of all the adults over the age of 20 in California. I thought you would be interested in knowing what the comparable figures were for your own state of Texas. So I asked the California Department of Public Health to get me the estimates, the official estimates, and they did. According to these estimates, there are just about than a quarter of a million alcoholics in the state of Texas, just a shade under 4% of all the adults in Texas over the age of 20 are in some stage of alcoholism. Notice the percentage in Texas is about half that of California, and the only way I can explain it is in the words of a famous architect who said if you could tilt the entire United States, all the crackpots would wind up in California, and I sometimes think somebody did it. At any rate, it's obvious with these figures that whatever else it is, alcoholism is not a skid row disease. Actually, again, the official figures are that somewhere around one alcoholic in 25 or 30 is on our skid rows. And this raises the question of where are the others and who are they? Well, as to where they are everywhere that alcohol is available for drinking. And as to who they are, they can be anybody. Apparently, all you need to catch alcoholism, so to speak, is to be exposed to it by drinking something that contains alcohol, just as all you have to do to be exposed to smallpox is to be exposed to it if you're going to catch it. I think of the wide variety of men and women that I have seen, all occupations and professions, that I know are alcoholics, most of them in AA. I have seen in California literally children come into AA. By this I mean boys of 15 and girls, boys and girls of 15 and 16. I know they're alcoholics. I know their stories. At the other extreme, there's a man in Pasadena whom I love. Everybody else does too. Everybody calls him Pappy. This man is now 94 years old and has been sober 14 years. He came to AA at the age of 80. He was staying in a Goodwill home, and they told him they'd throw him out. The old story. And he came to AA. He even started his own group because it's a little difficult for him to stay up as late at night as some of the rest of us children can. So those are the extremes of age. As to occupation and profession, we've already seen during this conference that nearly every occupation and profession is represented among alcoholics. So I'll merely name a few that came as a big surprise to me when I first came to AA. I would not expect moral and spiritual leaders to become alcoholics because we think of this as a moral disease. Yet I know ministers, priests or alcoholics and AA members. I've heard of rabbis. I don't know any. I would not expect a healer of sick minds to be an alcoholic because we think of this as a psychological or emotional disease, and it is. But I know of psychiatrists. I know several clinical psychologists who are alcoholics and AA members. I know four in my own county of Los Angeles. Doctors, surgeons, people like these. We often hear the expression, sober as a judge. But I know judges who are alcoholics and AA members. I've come to know, particularly in the last year or two, a great many of the municipal judges in my county, and some of them tell me that there are several more Los Angeles municipal judges who probably should be AA members. But I wouldn't know anything about that. I'm merely quoting some judges. Politicians, well, it's notorious. I know I'm not violating anonymity here. I think everyone knows that the governor of Iowa has been an AA member for 12 years. I think you saw the national news magazines and newspapers a few months ago. An ex-governor of West Virginia had been discovered driving a cab in Chicago. He is now sobered up. I'm told he's joined AA and is on his way to a recovery. So you can have a high political office. This does not keep you from being an alcoholic. The same thing is true of the police. I know policemen in California, police matrons, state troopers, this sort of thing, who are alcoholics and AA members. Being an eminent scientist, university professor, or this sort of thing, doesn't keep you from being an alcoholic either. My own sponsor is now chairman of the Department of History of a quite a large Midwestern university. And so it goes, you see, a non-selective disease in a certain respect. All you need to do to catch it, if you're going to catch it, is to be exposed to it. But not everyone who's exposed to smallpox catches it, and neither does everyone who's exposed to alcoholism. Only a fraction of those who are exposed catch it. Nobody knows the percentages in here or the proportions, but I would suppose that maybe one drinker in five, maybe one in eight, something like that, becomes an alcoholic. The rest can go on drinking merrily as long as they live. And I, for one, wish them more power. I have absolutely nothing against drinking or alcohol. But if you do become an alcoholic, as I did, then you have a disease that is permanent. All the authorities, with a very few exceptions, agree that once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. This disease is not curable in the sense that a person who becomes an alcoholic can ever hope to drink normally again. It's a chronic disease. I think of it in terms of diabetes. We all know that the diabetic, in most cases, can live quite comfortably with his diabetes, provided he lives in a certain way, which for him includes uronase or insulin, something of this sort, and provided he observes a certain diet, which in his case excludes sugar completely. Within these limits, he's okay, and this is fortunate. Similarly, as an alcoholic, I can live quite comfortably with my disease, provided I try to live, because I don't always succeed, in a certain way, which I call the AA way for short, and provided I observe a certain diet, which in my case excludes alcohol completely. within these limitations, I'm okay. And this is very fortunate for me because my disease, besides being permanent, is progressive. It always gets worse, apparently. It never gets better. And unless it is arrested in some such way as this, it almost always seems to end in a very messy, permanent type of insanity, or an equally messy, painful, lingering death. Now, I didn't know these facts before I came to AA. I learned them after I got here. And there's one fact I learned that is even more important to me than the others. And this is that to the medical profession and the psychiatric profession, alcoholism is still a mysterious disease. It is an obscure disease in a certain sense. By this I mean that its causation is not yet understood, and neither is its underlying nature. I don't make this statement lightly. You'll find it in all the literature on alcoholism. I was in a conference not more than a month ago at the neuropsychiatric hospital at UCLA in the research unit that deals with alcoholism. And one of the last things that Dr. Keith Dittman, the director of this unit, which has worked for several years, told us was, as yet, we're doing a lot of research, but we don't know what causes alcoholism. We don't know what it really is underneath. In other words, as we've already heard during this conference, and as we can read in the big book, the drinking itself is a symptom, but it happens to be a symptom that can kill. When a symptom develops to the point where it can kill, you might almost say it becomes a disease in its own right. This sometimes happens with fevers. We all know that a fever is a symptom of something else. But occasionally a fever will get up to 108 degrees, somewhere in that range, where it can quickly destroy the mind or kill unless it is reduced. And then the problem for the physician is to get rid of the fever and worry about finding the cause of the disease treating that later. There is a growing body of medical and research opinion that really says what our book has been saying for many, many years, that perhaps alcoholism involves at least two illnesses, a bodily illness and a mental or emotional illness. As we say in our book, an allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. Perhaps a physician today, a non-alcoholic physician, might use different language. He might say some peculiar kind of change in the body, the nature of which is not understood, which tends to occur after a number of years of drinking. Whatever it is, this change, once it sets in, is apparently permanent. It's apparently not reversible. It may even be progressive in itself. There is a growing body of evidence, both on animals and on human beings, which seems to point the finger at the central nervous system, but the future will have to tell us what that is. Whatever it is, there's nothing that can be done about this. If this happened in my body, it's over with. I'll always have it. In AA language, for me, one drink is too many, and 1,000 is not enough. I have permanently lost control, the ability to control in that sense. Well, if this were all there were to my disease, it would be very easy to deal with. If it were like an allergy, I have friends who are allergic to strawberries. They get giant hives from them. They have no trouble leaving strawberries alone. But you see, I had the other disease. I had the compulsion. I had the obsession. This strange, mysterious force that I've already mentioned that had me drinking sometimes when I didn't even want it. This, fortunately, can be cured. And this, to me, is what the AA program deals with. I don't know what the origin of this obsession is in any particular case. I have some clues, I think, in my own case. I don't think it's very important. I will tell you a little about my background just in case it helps with someone's identification. We often hear alcoholics say that they came from alcoholic families. I didn't. Nobody in my family drank. I can't point to that as a cause. I can't point to lack of economic security. I grew up in a good deal of economic security. I can't point to lack of religious training. I had a good religious training. I can't point to lack of education. I had a good education with advanced degrees. So I can't point to any of those things, but I can point to something that I became aware of when I was very young, maybe 3 or 4 years old. Somehow, there grew up between me and the rest of the human species, including my own family, what I think of as a kind of glass wall. Through this wall, I could communicate intellectually. 2 and 2 is 4, or will it rain tonight? That sort of thing. But not the free, easy give and take of feeling, both of liking and disliking, of love and hate. I think what happened was, at this point in my life, I became stunted, spiritually, or if you don't like that word, emotionally. I think I stopped growing in some area of my life, and I suspect I know the reasons, but they don't matter. Just as we've seen some children grow normally bodily for several years, and then one part of the body simply stops growing. And so we have an adult with an arm or a leg that is child-sized. Well, I think this happened to me spiritually. At any rate, I was in pain inside. I was full of anxiety, resentment, and hatred. And I immediately set to work trying to conceal these feelings from myself and the world around me. I tried to imitate other people. I built up a very complicated system of defenses. But I was in pain. And for the relief of this pain, as a boy, I took refuge in books. Books were my alcohol. But when I got into my teens, I discovered that books are no substitute for girls. Now I was skinny, bashful, covered with pimples, had a bad stammer, and I discovered alcohol. Alcohol did for me socially what books had done for me when I was a boy. And this isn't bad. Millions of kids make this discovery every year, and they don't become alcoholics. Alcohol is a good social lubricant. But you see, I was already sick. I think of myself in terms of a person who has headaches. Now, when I have headaches, I take aspirin. And aspirin works pretty well with me. The headache goes away, and there's no more trouble. The aspirin doesn't cure the headache, but it relieves the pain, and the cause takes care of itself. But suppose I had the kind of headaches that might be caused by a growing brain tumor. In such a circumstance, I might take more and more aspirin to relieve this pain, and it might work at first, but the pain would always come back. So I might take more and more aspirin, and eventually the aspirin would become a poison, because I would be taking so much. Well, I didn't suffer from a physical headache, but I think of myself as suffering from a spiritual headache, or a headache of the soul. And when I got into my teens, I discovered that, in the words of the Alka-Seltzer ads, relief is just a swallow away. In other words, alcohol became my spiritual aspirin, and it worked just fine. I was one of the lucky ones. My disease progressed very, very slowly. But the mere blows of life themselves are likely to aggravate any condition we have to have, and so it was inevitable that as my spiritual headache became worse and worse, I used more and more of my spiritual aspirin. Eventually, it became a poison to me. I became addicted to it because alcohol is a true narcotic in the sense of morphine, but rather weakly addicted. And eventually, I collapsed. As we say in AA, I hit bottom. It was in this condition that I came to you. I suppose, in terms of our program, and I'm going to speak only the first 3 steps, I think I knew that I was powerless over alcohol and my life was unmanageable before I got here. I think I knew that only some power greater than myself could restore me to, I wouldn't have liked the word sanity, but say normality. I knew this power couldn't be medicine or psychiatry. They'd failed me. It couldn't be religion. I'd rejected that in my teens. It couldn't be myself. I'd failed. What could it be? Well, as I've told you, I came here and I discovered you were people like me. And you were comfortable, and you weren't drinking. So I decided to do what you told me to. You gave me the book, and you said, here are 12 steps. If you try your best to live according to these 12 steps, you have a chance of growing up from spiritual infancy, at least in the direction of spiritual and emotional adulthood. The steps were something like a ladder. Well, I decided to do what you told me to, whether I liked it or not. And so I got hold of the 12 steps and started studying them. And I came to number 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. And right there I gagged on that word God. I told my wife, it looks to me as if I have come across another of these crackpot religions. And if my sobriety depends on my adhering to anything like this, I am eventually going to get drunk. Yet I was faced with the undeniable fact that you were like me. You were sober. You were comfortable. I'd said I'd do what I could. So I began to study the 12 steps, and pretty soon I discovered not all the steps mentioned God. The fourth doesn't, for instance. Sometimes when a step mentions God, there's something else quite practical you can do in it. In the fifth step, for instance, you can admit your defects of character, the things you've done wrong to another person, as well as to yourself, and leave God out of it. So I worked the 12 steps this way, and I stayed sober for about a year. Now, you see, what you had done was to give me the fourth gift. You had given me a program, a method, a set of tools that I could use to grow up with so I wouldn't feel this terrible inner pain that had had me drinking. So that was the fourth gift. But I was still faced with this fact, this word God. And it bothered me, but I did the steps as well as I could within these limitations. And I was sober this way for perhaps a year before the nature of my error dawned on me. And I always talk about it because I think it's very common among people who come to AA, particularly if they're the so-called sophisticates or have technological or scientific training. It finally dawned on me that when I had made that initial, very simple decision, really in the first week of my coming to AA, the decision to do what you told me to, whether I liked it or not, I had, in fact, given my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood that power for the first time in my life, not as some creed, theology, or church had defined or described God. Then I realized with full force that all that the second step said was a power greater than myself. It left it up to me to define that power or think of it in any way I chose as long as it was greater than I was. Then I read the traditions and I found that the second tradition says our ultimate authority is a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. And so if I didn't know what this power was, I knew where it was. It was right here in the group. And then, so to speak, I was in. I then realized that before this, I had had two gods in my life. There had been the Methodist God of my childhood, whom I had interpreted as a God of vengeance. I had rejected this God as preposterous in my middle teens. I had taken my next God, the God of the scientists and the philosophers, of the Einsteins and the Bertrand Russells. This is a perfectly real God. This is a God that made the universe and everything in it, including the very laws of logic by which we think about it. But this law, God, you see, was remote. I couldn't give my will and my life over to it, but I could to you. So this was the way it happened to me. This was the way I was given the final gift, and I don't know whether to speak of this as a gift or not, because I had to do something. I had to make a decision. I had to dedicate myself. But I will call it a gift. The gift of surrender to a power greater than myself. I finally came to conclude that it doesn't matter, as long as one observes the reality, what one calls this power. Many people come into AA with this feeling about the word God, and I think one can call it anything. There are other words for God in other religions. Allah or Jehovah. These are legitimate words. There are historical words like Jupiter and Zeus. You can use a very intimate word because I think it starts here with most of us. We can call it our group or AA. Or we can give it a completely neutral name like it and not worry anymore about it. Or if we happen to belong to the beat type, we have some in our part of the country, You can call it Zen, if you like. Or if you want to be very scientific and very psychiatric, you can give it a good psychiatric name, the name empathy. I use this name for a particular reason. The psychiatrists who deal with very tiny children, by this I mean infants under a year, tell us that infants cry and are disturbed and tense for many reasons. We know this as parents, hunger, thirst, this sort of thing. But this tension can be relieved by satisfying the need, feeding the child or whatever is necessary. But there is one form of painful tension which is different. This is anxiety. The experts say that the child becomes anxious when the person acting as mother, which doesn't have to be a woman even, becomes anxious herself. When the mothering one becomes anxious, the child becomes anxious without even being touched. Anxiety is contagious. And there are some psychiatrists, particularly the Harry Stack Sullivan group of psychiatrists, who believe that some force or power is involved, similar in its own way to magnetism or gravity, but not yet measurable by any known means. And they call this empathy. Now, the peculiar thing about empathy-induced anxiety is that you cannot relieve it by satisfying a need. The only way in which it can be relieved is the same way in which it was aroused. When the mothering one becomes secure, then eventually the child becomes free from anxiety by empathy. I suggest I came to you as a spiritual infant, anxious and unsecure, stunted in this area of my life. I found myself for the first time in my life among people exactly like me, but secure. And so maybe it was that type of empathy. Who knows? Essentially, this is all I have to say, except one thing more. For those of you who may be comparatively new to this program and who are scientifically or technologically trained, and in a state like Texas, and in this part of Texas particularly, that must include nearly everybody, I would like to ask, why does this program work in the scientific sense of the word? Now, this question was raised for me by a mathematical physicist when I had been sober about a year. He was a 36-year-old genius, and I wish I could tell you that he recovered and made the program, but he didn't. He died as a consequence of alcoholism about a year later. But during his life, when I knew him, he insisted he could accept this program if, as a scientist, he could understand why it worked. What do you weigh? What do you measure? What's the formula? What's the chemistry? I couldn't tell him. Well, his death forced me to think about it. And this is the conclusion I have come to, for what it's worth. In the sense in which he raised the question, I have never met anyone, nor have I read anything, that would tell me why this program works. It certainly seems like a very unscientific way to deal with a disease. There are no long names, no white coats, no needles, no special formulas, nothing but these simple 12 steps. Yet, although we lack this kind of scientific statement, we have evidence which amounts to proof in itself. And this evidence consists of the more than 350,000 alcoholics who are now sober as a result of the AA program. 30 years ago, this month, when this program began, as we heard and saw Bill say this afternoon, for practical purposes, there weren't any. Here and there, there have always been sporadic, occasional recoveries from alcoholism over the centuries. But by and large, 30 years ago, all an alcoholic like me had to look forward to was this miserable downhill slide to insanity and death. Now, that's all changed in the last 30 years. AA has demonstrated for the first time that alcoholics can recover on a mass basis. AA's demonstration of this fact is what has stimulated the medical research, the interest of religious people in alcoholism. Up to that time, they all washed their hands of us because we were so hopeless. Well, that has changed. And since alcoholism is a disease then, and since AA has accomplished this result, this must mean that whatever else it is, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is a medical discovery of the highest importance, comparable in its own way with the discovery of penicillin, which was also a medical accident. There are numerous parallels in medical history to this sort of thing, and I'm going to use only one because it's one that everybody knows. This is smallpox and vaccination. We all know, I think, that in the 18th century, at least 10 million men and women died in Europe and England of smallpox. We know that smallpox is rare today because of vaccination. Most of us know that Dr. Edward Jenner is credited with discovering vaccination in the year 1796. Yet not so many know that Jenner really didn't discover it. He was told when he was a boy of 17, apprenticed to a doctor, he was told by a milkmaid that she could never catch smallpox because she had already had cowpox. Well, Dr. Jenner heard this story over the years of his medical practice from the ignorant country people of England. They couldn't read or write, but they could observe. Finally, he put it to the test. He took an 8-year-old boy named Jimmy Phipps, who had never had smallpox. He inoculated Jimmy from the open cowpox sores on the wrist of a milkmaid who had it. Jimmy caught cowpox, and when he recovered, Dr. Jenner inoculated him in the same way from an active case of smallpox, and Jimmy didn't get it. That was the first case of vaccination. Essentially, it's the same today. We're given cowpox, so we won't catch smallpox. But what interests me is that Dr. Jenner didn't know why vaccination worked. No doctor of his day knew. No one knew what caused smallpox, and no one knew what it was underneath. It was to be about 75 years, before it was discovered that bacteria caused disease. And smallpox is not caused by a bacterium, but by a virus. And that was discovered only a few years before I was born. So you see, for about 100 years, human lives were being saved from this terrible disease by a simple, simple process. Now, nobody knew what caused the disease or what it was really underneath or why this process worked. Now, I think someday the researchers and the scientists are going to discover what alcoholism really is underneath. The etiology, as they say. I think they may very probably discover what causes alcoholism. I think it's barely possible that they may discover, in the scientific sense, why this program works. I think it's possible they may improve on it. I have an open mind on these matters. As the end of our book says, we know only a little. The future will reveal more. But you know, if it's going to be like smallpox and vaccination, that day of discovery might not come for another 100 years. And I can't wait. So I'm content to work this program exactly as it is. I'll leave it to the scientists and the researchers to learn the whys and wherefores, and I'll look over their shoulders and cheer them on and wish more power to them. Meanwhile, I'm working the program. Part of my working it has been speaking to you tonight. You've been very kind, very generous. I am grateful to you. I am more grateful to this power greater than myself that expresses itself to me through you. I now use the word God for this power. It doesn't bother me a bit. I think it's a fine common denominator. But if you happen to be new in AA and don't like the word God, use a word you do like. Got a wide choice. You've got Jehovah, Allah, Zeus, my group, AA, it, Zen, empathy, or maybe I can give it one more name. This is a word we've heard before. I think it's something we can all agree on. It's something we feel at every AA meeting. I felt it the first time I ever walked into your presence, and it's what got me sober and keeps me sober. I certainly feel it now, and I give it back to you. That's love. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.